Special guest tonight, Chuck Mishler. A lot of you have been sending me emails to get Chuck back on the program. It's been almost 2 years. In a moment, Chuck Mishler, right here on Coast to Coast AM, the Bible Code. Chuck Mishler received a congressional appointment to the U.S. Naval Academy and then served in the U.S. Air Force. After leaving active duty, he became branch chief of the Department of Guided Missiles at Laurie Air Force Base. He has earned a master's degree in engineering from UCLA and a Ph.D. from Louisiana Baptist University. Chuck has always worked as a systems engineer at TRW, followed by a senior analyst position, serving both the intelligence community and the Department of Defense. He also worked for the Ford Motor Company, where he established the very first international industrial computer network. During the past 30 years or so now, Chuck has also served on the board of directors of more than a dozen public companies and was chairman and CEO of six of them. Chuck Mishler, our guest on Coast to Coast. Chuck, it has been way too long, my friend. Welcome back.
Well, nice to be with you, George. I'm flattered to be asked back. When I'm invited the first time, I'm grateful. When I'm invited back, I'm amazed.
It's been almost 2 years.
Yeah, well, we've been busy in the meantime, and so have you.
Huh? We all have. What have you been doing lately?
Well, the same thing I've been doing in the past, except perhaps a little more intensely. I've written a few more books and formed an online worldwide fellowship that we use the internet to communicate. We've got subscribers all over the world, so
good for you, Chuck.
You betcha.
Good for you. Look, over the last couple weeks, I've been inundated from people who have said, look, get him back on. What happened to him? So,
well, I'm flattered to have that following, and I appreciate the exposure.
You know, you're an expert in the Bible Code, and I wanted you just to take a few moments, Chuck, and kind of assess for us world events based on some of the things that you know are in the Bible Code. I mean, it seems to me if one thought that the Bible Codes were accurate, it's pretty uncanny what's starting to unfold now.
Well, it sure is, but I think to sort of reset the zero so that our listeners won't get confused, when people use the term Bible Code, they typically mean what a particular code that's called an equidistant letter sequence. And those are the ones that have been sensationalized. They're the ones that are very controversial. And we do cover them in the book. But the thing that I like to emphasize right at the outgo is that that's just one kind of encryption of many different kinds that are in the Bible. It's the one that's popular. It's the one that has been sensationalized. In fact, there have been many things that are quite contrived and quite exaggerated, and as a result, and obviously very controversial. So I want to emphasize that we don't really focus ourselves or limit ourselves to that particular arena, but there are discoveries that have been made about the biblical text that are really quite astonishing. In fact, the most interesting ones don't require a computer. They're pretty direct kinds of things, but we obviously become very aware that there are that the biblical text, the 66 books that we casually call the Bible,
mm-hmm.
are actually an integrated message system. And what I mean by that is that it's not just a thematic issue, that there's a theme in the Old Testament fulfilled in the New, that sort of thing, but rather that the actual structure of the text is anticipatory. That is, there are structures explicit in the text and also hidden under the text that anticipate things before they happen. We have 66 different books that have been penned by over 40 different guys over a period of over 1,700 years that are integrated. It's an integrated message. That fact itself is startling, and one really has to discover that for themselves. But if you get that far in your understanding, then you get confronted with a second discovery that emerges from that. That if that's true, if this is an integrated message system I've just described, if that's true, then its origin had to be extraterrestrial. That is, it had to be from outside our time domain because it anticipates history before it happens. And not just in terms of prophecies in the traditional sense, but the very structures, the very idioms are anticipatory. And so that's what causes my technical background is really in information sciences, and that it's that aspect that has caused me to be very absorbed with this this whole area of study. And as we begin to understand the what I'll call, for lack of a better term, the classical biblical scenario, the anticipation of what the Bible seems to lay out as coming, what's astonishing is that we see history converging in exactly a kind of an arena. We have an organization that tries to monitor what we call the strategic trends, over a dozen of them on the planet Earth.
Right.
Each one is biblically relevant. Each one is one that the Bible touches on. And yet what we're discovering is that all dozen of these things are converging on that scenario that has been looked for by scholars for literally 19th century. So it's an interesting time to undertake a study like this, because as we watch day by day, month by month, year by year, it's quite astonishing to realize that we're moving towards the climax of human history.
Is it possible that this knowledge might have been obtained from time travelers? I mean, far-fetched as it may seem?
I don't know how else, using that in a broad sense, I can't see how else it could be assembled, because it anticipates things before they happen. And the history itself is laid out in advance. And so whether you look, in fact, time travel opens up a whole other kind of discussion, but that would be one attempt to explain the text, you bet.
Now, one would say to you, though, Chuck, it's the Word of God. That's why we know.
Well, I happen to believe that's actually the best explanation we have, because because of a person that history centers itself on, namely the one that Mel Gibson wrote the movie about, and it is about a nation, its history, its origin, its ups, its downs, and its destiny, and out of that nation comes a person that is the centroid of history. But I would take that view very aggressively, that's exactly what it is. But to many people that would be a very prejudicial perspective.
Let's go back to when these 60 plus texts were written, and if you would, Chuck, this is fascinating. Kind of paint a picture for us on who's writing them, how they're writing them, and what they do with them when they're done.
Well, first of all, let's take it really simply. There's a collection of 39 of these that we call the Old Testament. These are Hebrew scriptures that were collected in variety of ways, but you get their codification pretty much about the 6th century B.C. But the important thing from an objective analysis point of view is these 39 books were translated from their Hebrew, from the original Hebrew, into Greek about 3 centuries before Christ's ministry. In other words, about 285 B.C., if you were Jewish in those days, living almost anywhere in the world, you probably didn't know Hebrew. You spoke Greek. Greek was the enforced international commercial language.
Mm-hmm.
And because of your desire as a Jewish person in those days to have your religious texts in a language you could enjoy, you would have preferred Greek. So in response to that opportunity, Ptolemy Philadelphus, the ruler in what was probably clearly the dominant literary center in those days, Alexandria, Egypt, impaneled 70 Jewish scholars to translate their Hebrew scriptures into Greek. And the reason I mention this particular documentation is because we have a number of copies of that work product. That is, we have the translation of the Old Testament into Greek.
Uh-huh.
That was finished about 270 B.C. The term for that document is called the Septuagint. That's a fancy word for just meaning 70. But the point is, that anchors a copy of the Old Testament in black and white, well documented by any competent encyclopedia, at nominally 270 B.C. Now, the reason I point to that, what's astonishing as we study those documents, they detail several hundred details of the life of Christ 3 centuries before he shows up in history. And so one of the most astonishing studies a person can take is take a look at the New Testament, the 27 books that emerged in one lifetime. The previous 39 obviously were accumulated over literally about 1700 years. But the ones that we associate with the New Testament, which we have essentially the Greek original, virtually the originals, we have them within a decade or so of the actual events. The New Testament, as we look at the life of Christ, it's astonishing to discover that his genealogy is laid down in advance, the details of his death in ways that were not even invented back until about 90 BC. The crucifixion was not a form of execution. It was invented by the Persians about 90 BC, widely adopted, obviously, by the Romans. But the details of Christ's life in the New Testament are so astonishingly detailed in the Old Testament that in and of itself is a staggering discovery as one gets into it. Mel Gibson's popular movie *The Passion* was quite a piece of work.
Sure.
But it does suffer several serious defects. One of which, it portrays the crucifixion as a tragedy, and the reality is it wasn't a tragedy. It was an achievement that was specified centuries before.
A necessary achievement.
Yes, exactly. One that was actually planned before the foundation of the world, if you really get into the biblical perspective. So this aspect of prophecy is one of, in fact, to give you a feeling of the precision, there in the book of Daniel, in chapter 9, it describes a visit to Daniel by Angel Gabriel and lays down a prophecy, four little verses that close that chapter, that when you analyze that, pins down the exact day in advance that the Messiah of Israel would present himself as a king to Jerusalem. He did that, of course, riding that donkey that day that we celebrate in the church as the triumphal entry. What's astonishing, it was Sir Robert Anderson in 1894 that published a milestone book called The Coming Prince, in which he unraveled that prophecy, and it turns out it pins down in advance the exact day that Jesus rode that donkey into Jerusalem, presenting himself as a king. In fact, when you read Luke 19, and you discover that Christ held him accountable to know that day. And so these are things that are astonishing, because setting aside who wrote Daniel when, we could go into that, it's well documented, but that's not the point. It's part of the Septuagint translation that's 3 centuries before the event, and that describes it in advance. So I allude to these. These are classic examples. And, of course, as we shift to the modern day, we discover that there is an invasion of Israel by Russia and its allies that's going to be intervened, conspicuously thwarted, if you will, by God himself in terms that are astonishing. There's two reasons the Ezekiel 38 passage is well known to Bible buffs. One is it is that occasion that God intervenes to thwart this invasion of Israel. But the other reason it's so well known, it appears to describe the use of nuclear weapons. It describes the fact that the weapons left over from that battle will be supply all the energy needs for Israel for 7 years. It describes that they'll spend 7 months clearing the land, and it describes how they hire professionals to clear the battlefield, bearing everything downwind east of the Dead Sea.
Yes.
Then it goes on to say that if somebody passes through that region and finds something the professionals have missed, he doesn't touch it. He marks the location, lets the professionals deal with it. You know, that's pretty contemporary language for NBC.
It sure is.
So
absolutely.
I'm just prattling on with a few examples, but the point is some of these prophecies in the Scripture are very, very contemporary. In fact, that's why many people are getting quite apprehensive, because the alignment of nations that are detailed with Russia are all in place except one, and that's Turkey. Turkey is presently trying hard to be part of the EU.
Yes.
There are a lot of reasons why most observers think they will not make it, that they're going to be rejected. When they do, if that's the case, they will turn to their destiny will be return eastward And they're the one missing. They are obviously in the biblical passage. They're very, very conspicuous participants with Russia and Iran and the rest in this ill-fated...
And China. We got to throw them in the mix.
Sure. So the point is, it's an area that is an exciting time to do a little study in, because we appear to be heading for some very, very significant climaxes here.
And what do you think the significance is of what you were just talking about, a obvious nuclear event?
What do I think about it?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's coming.
I do, too.
I just got back from an insider's briefing in Israel. We got briefed by the IDF, the Mossad, and the rest. And the current thinking among the military there is that Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, who is aggressively trying to get the nuclear capability, will probably have what he's after within a year. In fact, some estimates are even as near as March. So if he gets his hands on that kind of capability, he's been very forthright and very articulate as to what he plans to do with it. And he plans to attack both Israel and the U.S. with it. When the Majlis, the parliament of Iran, voted last October, they voted on their nuclear program. Out of the 290 members of their parliament, 247 stood and voted by shouting, "Death to the United States, death to Israel." And what's a shock is that, to many, is that we always have known that Israel is a one-bomb country. That is, one nuke over Tel Aviv and it's over.
Oh, yeah.
With the shock that has come up is that the U.S. also turns out to be a one-bomb country. Congress impaneled a commission to assess the vulnerability of the United States to an electromagnetic pulse attack, an EMP attack. And that commission, a Blue Ribbon Commission headed up by Bill Graham and the top dozen of our scientists that are active in the E-ring of the Pentagon, the commission published the report in July of 2004, the same month the 911 commission published its report. And of course, that's why the press jumped on that.
Yes, and the other one got buried.
Yeah, but it's on the internet. Anyone can read it. All they have to do is look, Google the commission to assess the vulnerability of the United States to an electromagnetic, or it's abbreviated strangely, EMP. I don't know why engineers can't abbreviate more logically. EMP is a two-word expression, but they have three letters. They call it EMP. Anyway, the point is, that report's on the internet, and anyone can take a look at it. And I encourage your listeners that have internet capability to go ahead and read it, because what it points out is that one thermonuclear bomb, hydrogen bomb, at a very high altitude over the U.S., will generate a very intensive electromagnetic pulse line of sight, and that pulse is intense enough to fry the circuits on any significant length wire, which means you lose telecommunications, which also means you lose power. And so the metropolitan areas will end up, for example, having a disruption of power, not just for a few hours or days, permanently. And the way the assessment of the report suggests that the bomb in the right place, in fact, the accuracy is not important, the altitude is. It's an altitude issue. If somebody can detonate a thermonuclear warhead at 100 miles or more up, it will plunge the United States back to the 19th century, because we're so dependent on microcircuits and the rest of it. So the other aspect to recognize once you read that report, the thing doesn't have to be over the center of the United States. If Iran can get an unmarked container ship within 200 miles of the eastern seaboard and launch one that would launch it over the eastern seaboard, you'll be effective over 70% of the population.
Do you believe they don't expect some kind of retaliation, Chuck?
They don't care. So you need to understand their mindset. Because they regard, they have the mindset of a suicide bomber. They believe that Iran itself is a small sliver of Islam. The commitment there is it's a theological issue. It's not one of greed or territory in the traditional sense. They're willing to sacrifice themselves in the interests of Allah.
Hold that thought. Back in a moment with Chuck Mishler and Coast to Coast AM. After Dark newsletter, we're giving you a couple free CDs with a subscription. They are the interviews that Art conducted with the late Father Malachi Martin. Take advantage of it. These are collector items, and you get the After Dark newsletter to boot. Call 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505, or go online at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Chuck Mishler. Chuck, let's pick up a little bit on what I agree with, and that is that these groups of people who are controlling Iran are suicidal, and well, they don't absolutely care what they take out.
Well, and the examples of those are suicide bombers. You need to understand their mindset. They really have, they're very serious about their beliefs. They believe that if they die in the service of Allah, that they will, you know, they're going to enter into an eternity that has all have the 72 virgins and all those things that we, you know, as a non-Muslim, you look at that and you chuckle because they seem so bizarre. But you need to understand, these aren't deluded crazies. These are people who are just simply sincerely committed to their religious perspective, which comes from the Quran and comes from the leadership of Islam. And so the point is, Ahmadinejad is of the extreme sect of those. He's part of a sect that Khomeini, when he was in charge, tried to outlaw. It's so extreme. But the point is, he really believes that he has an eschatological mission. That eschatology being the study of the end times, what have you. But he really believes that he is going to be part of ushering in their concept of the end times. And so the point is, you need to understand the intensity to which they're committed to the destruction of Israel and the U.S. as they regard the U.S. as the primary backer, and indeed it is in many respects, of Israel. So the hostility there is very, very intense, and it's shared by of the truly committed Muslims, and so they have no fear of death. In fact, if you study the Quran and if you study the beliefs of Islam, the only certainty of having of going to heaven, so to speak, is if you die while in the jihad, exactly. And so. And that's what he's about. And, you know, you and I, as members of the West, look at that kind of perspective as bizarre, but we need to understand that these are not fringe types. These are people that are very serious about their religious system, and it's a system of values that's very, very different than those with which we take for granted in the West. But it's... And when they were broke, it didn't matter. But when they, with the oil revenues, and now with their access to nuclear technology, we can't ignore that agenda. And the disturbing thing is that there's nothing hidden here. They're very open and articulate about their goal, and their goal.
Oh yeah, they're
is
not hiding anything.
The United States.
You know, this sort of reminds me, Chuck, of the old scorpion and the frog story.
Exactly.
The old scorpion, some people might not know what they're at home going, what's he talking about? The scorpion needed a ride across the lake, and the only one sitting there on the shore was a frog. So the scorpion goes up to the frog and says, hey, I want to jump on your back and swim me across the lake. And the frog said, there's no way, because you're going to sting me and you're going to try to kill me. And the scorpion said, yeah, right. And then I die in the process? No way. I'm not going to drown. So the scorpion hops on the frog's back halfway across the lake. The scorpion stings the frog. So as the frog is sinking underwater to die and the scorpion dying with him, the frog looks at him and says, why did you do that? You just killed both of us. And the scorpion simply said, it's my nature. And that's very much the case here.
He said it's the Middle East. That was his explanation.
Yeah.
And
scary.
That's a classic tale. But the self-destructiveness, you know, it's even within Islam, something that most people, once they've studied, they're not aware of. There's the field of Islam is split into two houses: the house of the Sunnis and the Shiites. Most Arab countries are Sunni. The Shiites are Iran and Yemen and a few other segments, but they hate each other almost as much as they hate Israel. So you're dealing here with a 4,000 or 5,000 year legacy of hate. That is these are deep roots, and it's something that from the West, because we have a whole different cultural background, it's hard for us to imagine. We tend to dismiss these kinds of people as deluded fringe or crazies or something. No, they're very serious, committed people, very intelligent people, these are not illiterates. These are people that are very, very capable intellectually as well as otherwise. And so we're up against some really serious tides of history here.
So we either continue to annihilate and attack, or we let it happen, but eventually some rogue nation, some sick person, is going to get his hands on a nuke and use it.
Well, exactly. And these people are incredibly well-resourced because of the oil revenues in the Middle East. They have incredible resources. And whether you're talking about Saudi Arabia or whether you're talking about Iran, or go through the list. And the situation is one, tragically, which is going to cause a preemptive attack. Either Israel or the U.S. or someone is going to, in extremis, preempt this for their own survival.
I agree. I'm not so sure, Chuck. Will the preemptive attack take out the capability, or will it just delay it?
Well, first of all, that happened back in 1981. Iraq was on. Yes. They had a reactor going on in Osiris, and back then. A precision airstrike by Israel took out the reactor at Osiris, and of course the whole world criticized Israel for having done so, but aren't we glad they did, because had they not done that in Desert Storm, we would have been facing nuclear weapons.
And he would have used it.
But this case, it's much more complex, because in Iran, there are about 20 sites that are involved, many of them hardened deeply. It's not just the enrichment facilities for the Bushehr reactor. They also have heavy water facilities for plutonium. They clearly are going for nuclear. You know, the cover story is that they're just there trying to get a peaceful reactor for electricity and so forth, which is, of course, nonsense for a lot of reasons. But what it is really is a cover. The real issue is the plutonium activities for weapons-grade material. So if they can get that technology, even uranium, if it's enriched, you're at about 5%, it's good for power purposes, but for a reactor. But if you got to get up to about 90% for a weapon, the only difference is how many passes you make through the centrifuges, through the enrichment facility. So they're going for nuclear capability. And as they do, and we need to understand, too, by the way, Iran, this is not a third world country. These people are technologically sophisticated.
Extremely sophisticated. I was looking at a documentary on their medical programming, and, I mean, they've got researchers, they've got equipment, they've got the high-speed electronic microscopes. They know what they're doing, Chuck.
Oh, indeed. And incidentally, there is a large portion of the population that are moderate, are not really sympathetic to, but the people that are in charge are the extremists. And so there are a lot of people that have harbored hopes that there'd be a regime change, that somehow this would be overthrown. But that hasn't happened. In fact, it's gone the other way, that the people in charge are more powerful than ever. So the fate of the free world really hangs on the ability to thwart the people in charge as they race to try to gain this strategic capability. But you're right, whether it's Iran or one of these other rogue nations, for example, the North Koreans. Now, the North Koreans are a long way from really having a strategic capability. The little fizzle they did to get all the press is one thing, but they've got some distance to go. And the other thing about them, they live in the shadow of China. And if they get too far along, China will swat them with their fly swatter, and it's over. I don't worry about North Korea because China is quickly emerging to be the dominant military power on the planet Earth.
Why do you think, Chuck, China will swap North Korea? Why don't they want them to have these capabilities?
Well, first of all, at this point they can afford the luxury of tolerating it, but I think China wants to be in charge, and I don't think that a rogue group there that's in the trouble they're in is one that's let's put it the other way around. North Korea is smart enough not to antagonize either China or Russia. They're capable of dealing with that in a very rational way. But in the Middle East, it's a whole other ball game, between the CSS-2s, they have about 120 CSS-2s at the missile base at El Riyadh, El Salyel in the center part of Saudi Arabia. But as I understand it, that's still under control of China. They put it in, but they still retain control of it. So and that's probably good news because Saudi Arabia. This whole Saudi Arabia issue is a whole other story. We're a long way from Bible codes, but we are in a situation where.
But it ties in.
Yes, it does, because we are in a situation that the strategic predicament on the planet Earth today is a very, very precarious one, and so that's one reason we spend a lot of energy trying to maintain surveillance of what we call strategic trends, and clearly this is one of them. You know, the weapons of mass destruction is an area of real concern.
We'll spend all of next hour talking about the Bible codes, Chuck, and how they continue to tie into some of these. But your perspective, I think, on the world events is right on. And I have predicted on this program, because of the lackluster response by the United Nations, that probably Israel, though they have been holding back as long as they can, are going to do something, and they're going to do it pretty soon.
Oh, yeah. We need to understand as we watch the world events that both the European Union and the United Nations are intensely, deeply anti-Semitic. And that comes as a shock to people who haven't really watched this or studied this, but it's over 60% of the resolutions in the United Nations, both at the Security Council and the General Assembly, about 60% of those resolutions are resolutions that are anti-Israel. The fact that they even involve Israel is astonishing, because there's bigger problems the world has than just Israel. But the point is, the patterning and the moves. The UN, of course, has had an unblemished track record of failure no matter what they touch, and the corruption in the UN is so astonishing. It's amazing to me, just as an observer, that we tolerate all that. But clearly, from Israel's point of view, they don't get very excited about having UN inspection, because nothing ever comes of it, and it's always anti-Israel. So they're pretty much alone. And they need to focus on their own self-defense. And at this point, they've always been willing to do a preemptive strike if necessary. And the way things are going, it looks like they're going to be pressed to do something in the near future. Whether it's between now and March or whether it's longer than that, that's one that the experts debate on, but it's not something that's years away. It's something that's months away.
Was this prophesized in the Bible code?
Not specifically. I don't think there is. No, I don't think so. Let me put it this way. I personally am not aware of anything competent that deals with this issue specifically. No, I think that the fact that Iran and Russia will be ultimately involved in an invasion of Israel is very much detailed in Ezekiel 38 and 39, but that is not necessarily what's on the deck within the next 12 months. But I may have a blind spot here. I think both are true, but I'm not sure they're linked.
I mean, do we really understand the dates of all of this?
No, not really. No, I think timing is. I think we know sequences. We sort of we think we can infer pretty much from a biblical perspective a sequence. And experts in this area have some slightly different views. But no, I don't see any dating as such. I'm very skeptical of some of the stuff that's published that tries to set dates because I think I just don't see that as a, that's called divination and that's prohibited in the scripture.
Well, Chuck, fascinating. Now, the codes, the texts of the Bible, written by people who were told this, or was it through myth? How did they retain this?
Well, that's a good question. I think that they were. I think they were given direct revelation. One of the things that one aspect of the Bible codes is that we're on sound ground here now is that the Torah, the five books of Moses. Some of the properties of that text are such that you change one letter and it all falls apart. In other words, some of these things are so precise that they literally involve the interplay of the letters themselves, that as you study that, it's really astonishing, number one. But number two, that the precision that's involved is just frankly breathtaking. The genealogy of David is hidden in Genesis 38. And this is a book of Moses. This is long before Joshua, Judges, and Samuel, etc. The properties of the text itself are just breathtaking, and so that's a precision thing. That's a letter by letter kind of thing. There are discoveries being made, and I got to be careful here because I don't want to reveal. I don't want to jeopardize some people. There's going to be announced here in the next few months some discoveries that had come out of Saudi Arabia. Of artifacts that have been found at Jabal al-Lawz. This is a
you already know about this. This is fascinating.
The real Mount Sinai, frankly. But the point is, in these artifacts, they're discovering the early alphabet of that was given to Moses on Mount Sinai. A lot of the text of in the Bible that has to do about not making a graven image.
Yes.
Isn't dealing with idols, it's dealing with the hieroglyphics of Egypt. And what God gave Moses on the mountain was an alphabet. See, one thing most people don't realize that the original Hebrew alphabet is very, very distinctive. Most alphabets are either pictographs, like the hieroglyphics or Chinese, so forth, or they're phonetic. If you look at most of the alphabets people are familiar with, obviously the English alphabet or the Latin alphabet or even the Cyrillic or the Greek alphabets, these are all, the letters you put them together and they're phonetic. If you know the alphabet, you can pronounce the word. The Hebrew alphabet is not only phonetic, it's conceptual. There are about 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. If you know what each letter means, and that's easy to infer from the way it used to be written before Babylon. If you know the alphabet, all the words are composed of three-letter roots. And if you know the alphabet, you can read the root. The University of Arizona Hebrew Department pointed this out to me, fascinatingly, that if they teach the kids the early alphabet, and they understand how it was originally written, they can read. You can learn that in probably an hour. You can read about 80% of Hebrew, because the letters themselves carry meaning. For example, let me just give you an example. The first letter is the Aleph, which originally was drawn sort of like a longhorn steer. It later became our A. The second letter is Bet. It looked like a little horizontal line with a teepee on it. It meant house. That turns, through centuries, that turns to become our letter B later. But the point is, an aleph means first or strength, like an ox. The second letter is a beth or a house. If you put an aleph and a bet together, it's the leader of the house. It's the word for father. If you put a hey or a breath in that, you get the essence of the father, which is love. The point is, by putting the letters together, you get the concept of what the word means. It's not just phonetic. And so that makes Hebrew a very distinctive kind of language. If you study extraterrestrial languages, you'll discover it meets most of those specifications. But I hear the music, so we'll do that after the break.
We sure will. And we'll really jump into the Bible code.